The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And it turns out the institution most responsible for making the map of Europe, the Roman Catholic Church, wants to shake things up.
The Pope is calling for a kind of gentle revolution. Let's hold out a helping hand for anyone who's hurting. Let's not judge or condemn.
We discover this hour that there are no quiet revolutions in the Vatican. Pope Francis, the family, and a new look at the global flock of believers. That's what we'll be talking about. This is also an hour about maps and music and mercy. And at the end of the hour, mercenaries. We will see just how difficult this patient Pope Francis's gentle revolution will be in the end. We begin, though, with a new statement from the Vatican on the Catholic Church's view of families. It's titled Amoris Laetitia, or The Joy of Love. It is the culmination of two major meetings of bishops in the Vatican over the past 2 years, and we've covered those meetings on this program. Is this declaration the measure of how far Pope Francis can advance his mission for a merciful church? Let's listen once again to Vatican spokesman Greg Burke.
The Pope tells priests to be understanding, to walk with the people, to listen to their problems. Francis wants priests to listen not only with their ears, but also with their hearts.
Emphasis on problems and experiences of Catholics, not their lapses and deviations from tradition.
The Pope has spent a lot of time hearing confessions, and he knows people's failures. It's precisely because of that that he's always stressing God's mercy and forgiveness.
Again, that's Greg Burke, Vatican spokesman. With us is Michael O'Loughlin, a religion journalist and author of The Tweetable Pope. We're also joined by Lisa Duffy, a blogger, a divorce recovery expert, and author of several books, including her latest, The Catholic Guide to Dating After Divorce. Lisa and Michael, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me.
How significant is this shift in emphasis, Lisa, do you think? The idea of listening to people's failures and their hurting and their confessions, but not focusing on what it is they've done.
Well, I think that this is a very powerful message that Pope Francis is bringing to the church. It's the original message of Christ. It's the message of mercy. We're all sinners, and we all need mercy. And these are conversations in modern society that we need to have.
Michael, is this a revolution, or is this politics?
It's a revolution insofar as it's an incremental revolution. So the Pope is saying that the law of the church regarding marriage has not changed, but the way that people live out their lives has to be respected by clergy more, and that there is a new pathway now to make sure that people feel welcome in the church. Divorced and remarried Catholics especially can meet with their pastor and go on a journey of exploring their situation together and maybe end up being allowed to receive communion again. So in a way, it is a revolution. In a way, it simply brings what's already happening in many parishes out into the open light.
Michael, this is what the Pope said at the opening of the Synod in October of last year.
Ecco il sogno di Dio.
This is God's dream for his beloved creation, to see it fulfilled in the loving union between a man and a woman, rejoicing in their shared journey, fruitful in their mutual gift of self.
Now, I'm taking that statement out of context, but do you view that statement, which was very much at the beginning of a fairly controversial discussion about all these family issues, as a limit that he's setting or as a way station to something else? Michael?
I would say it's the Pope being a pastor. He's much more comfortable when it comes to pastoral issues, I would say, than exploring doctrinal issues. So it's Pope Francis saying, look, the reality for many Catholic families is that they don't always live up to rigid church teaching. And while that teaching is good, the Pope's saying, we need to acknowledge the reality. So he's saying, let's just get out there. Let's look at difficult cases one by one and explore a way forward together. So again, it's revolutionary in the sense that Jesus's message is revolutionary. Critics will say, you know, the Pope is being too liberal on issues. But a lot of Catholics, I think, will say, yes, this is what we've been saying for years. Our family lives are complicated, and we're glad that the Pope is recognizing this.
It sounds to me, and I'm, you know, just a Unitarian here, but it sounds as though the Pope is saying the important spiritual stuff is my department. The details about divorce and the specific following of rules, that's another department. You know, don't bother me with that stuff. Is that kind of separation going to work here, or is ultimately it going to be viewed as inconsistent?
No, I don't believe it's going to be viewed as inconsistent, because we do need to have these conversations. These are modern families, and they're facing these problems, and they do need to be discussed. But we are all called to follow Christ, and he revealed law to us. It was passed down to us by the apostles, and it's here for our good, so it's something that we all are called to follow.
Is striving enough, Michael O'Loughlin?
Yeah, I think it's the recognition that what Christ has passed down through the church is an ideal, and the Pope certainly holds up that ideal in a range of issues in this document. But the reality is it's a bit difficult out there. Life is messy, as the Pope has said several times. So I think he's simply calling on the church, which includes ministers, priests, and lay people, to just recognize that life is a bit challenging, and to, rather than judge, rather than to use the law as stones, as the Pope says, we should be able to accompany one another. And again, this hour is focused on mercy, while the Pope is focused on mercy. He has been for 3 years now. So it's another step forward in the Pope's attempt to make the church more merciful.
We're discussing the new statement from the Vatican on the Catholic Church's view of families. This is The Takeaway. How does the Catholic Church evaluate its own significance in the world? Is it by the number of people who are becoming Catholics, and the ways in which the Vatican can have influence on issues like the U.S. and Cuba, or the refugee crisis in Europe? Or is it simply how well we follow the rules?
I think there's a trend in the church to be less concerned with how big the institution is, how much power it has, and more concerned with kind of individual conversion, individual lives. How are Christians, how are Catholics living out the gospel message? So, you know, the church still has a bit of power in our society, as we saw with the U.S. and Cuba, as we see with the election. But at the same time, it's in a challenging place because of a variety of issues, demographic changes, the sex abuse scandals. So I think this Pope is more concerned with kind of individual behavior, how Christians are living out the gospel call to care for the poor and the marginalized. So, you know, Pope Francis, he's more concerned with being a pastor, helping people get through the messiness of life. So I don't see him as really trying to get the church to be a powerful player on the world stage as much.
Lisa Duffy, this is probably the most important question, and that is, among the people that you serve and speak to, what's likely to be the reaction of a sense from this message that the church is on your side if you're struggling in your families, and you know, maybe you will get communion someday? How meaningful is all that?
It's very meaningful, and I kind of echo what Michael has said. There's going to be some disappointment for some of the people who were expecting a significant change in procedure or church teaching. And then there will be some on the other side who are disappointed that he didn't clamp down hard enough, so to speak. But I think generally, especially with the changes that he made procedurally to the annulment process last September, there is a great sense of welcoming to the majority of divorced Catholics. I happen to be one of them formerly. And that's important. I think that this document will also help cement this feeling of welcomeness and encouragement to start rectifying situations and start coming and being a part of the congregation again and having that community of support. I think that will be the overriding sentiment.
Does the Catholic Church, Michael, have any celebration of modernity in this kind of a message? I mean, does it look at the proliferation of different kinds of families as a sign of the vigorous sort of health of the human species, or is it a Sodom and Gomorrah kind of thing?
I don't know if I would say a celebration of modernity as much as a recognition of reality. This is just life for many people. And, you know, an important part of this document is the Pope's thoughts on individual conscience, kind of guiding Catholics as they navigate these tricky issues. The Archbishop of Chicago, he always says that the Pope Francis wants to treat us like we're adults. And I think that this document kind of goes down that path again, saying, look, Catholics kind of know what their life is like. They need to form consciences that allow them to make these difficult decisions. And pastors and clergy should recognize that and kind of engage them on the same level. So again, it's a way of looking at the world as it is while striving for something better. I think the Pope applies that in many areas of life, not just these kind of thorny issues of marriage and sex.
Well, Michael and Lisa, I want you to have a great weekend. Thanks so much for spending the time to talk with us.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Michael O'Loughlin is a religion journalist and author of The Tweetable Pope. Spoke with us from WBEZ in Chicago. And Lisa Duffy is a blogger and divorce recovery expert and author of several books, including her latest, The Catholic Guide to Dating After Divorce. When I was just a little dork of a kid, one of my favorite things in the world to do was to turn on my shortwave radio and listen to the world far away. Magical sounds from different traditions and cultures. But scratchy and hard to hear. Coming up, we celebrate how the internet has made it possible to take a map of the world, a timeline of its history and music, combine them, and allow you to hear Paris in the 30s, Sydney in the 60s, Rangoon in the 50s. It's an addictive website that is going to distract you for the rest of today, I promise. But if you could take a time machine to any musical performance ever, where would you go and what musician or artist would you see? Miami, Florida. I'd go back to any weekend in the early 80s and see the Ramones or the Talking Heads or Blondie at CBGB's. The chance to see them so up close and maybe have a beer with them afterwards would be amazing. Oh, yeah.
This is Keith from Massachusetts, a lifelong deadhead. I can't choose just one show, but I'll pick the whole month of May, 1977 of the Grateful Dead.
It was a wealthy merchant, London he did dwell.
This is Rick from Driftwood, Texas, and if I could go to see any musical performance in time and artist, I'd like to go back to Woodstock and see Jimi Hendrix play. I think that would be just totally awesome and rad.
It's very far away. It takes about half a day to get there. Let me tell about my...
Jeff from South Carolina, without question, I would go to Woodstock, and I would enjoy the time there and all the artists that played. To me, that was a pinnacle of music, bringing people together for love and harmony. What a great time. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. Comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering tools for small business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, and custom frame prints and posters. Designed and printed in-store or ordered online at staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
In a world awash in weapons and unemployed soldiers, you might expect that war veterans would try to sell their services in places that need security. Market forces of supply and demand have turned parts of the high seas into a frontier of floating stockades, chocked full of weapons and fleets of commandos, ready to take a 911 call, you might say, from ships being attacked by pirates. It's been worth it to commercial shippers, whatever they are paying for these ocean-going cavalries. Since 2010, the threat of piracy to megaships in the waters around the Horn of Africa and in the Arabian Sea have fallen 45% since their high in 2010. Sarush Alvi is founder of Vice and convinced one of the mercenary captains to let him spend some time on one of these armed flotillas in the lawless international waters of the Gulf of Oman.
90% of the goods that we consume are transported by sea. And piracy had an $18 billion impact on the economy back in about 2012. And so they set up these armories out there to offer protection to the shipping industry.
Here's something from your documentary, a fellow by the name of Jan Gayat, who's a representative for the Djiboutian government. And here, I believe, what it's like to be on one of these armory ships.
Compliance is to have the ammunition separate. Is the 308 caliber. Every single items are tracked and listed. If one rifle is missing, there is something very wrong.
Who belongs to these weapons? Who do they belong to? And who has access to them?
So it's a private ship, this floating armory.
Right.
And they rent space, essentially, to all the different private military contractors. So let's say there's 15 different private security companies. They will rent space to store their guns and also a place for their employees, the mercenaries or private security guys, to sleep and eat. And they wait on this floating armory, and then they get the call that, okay, you've got a gig, there's a ship coming, you're going to be sent out to go onto this boat. And then they go and they sail with the boat and protect it as it goes through high-risk waterways. And it's essentially a big loophole that they aren't actually owning the guns. They're just – it's like a floating hotel, essentially. And that makes it legal. And it's crazy, actually, how many different private security companies are storing their weapons on these armories.
And let's explore this notion of private security companies. The difference between a private security company and an actual pirate might be hard to know out in these waters. I mean, everyone needs weapons. One person with a gun is no different than another person with a gun if we're not talking about people in national uniforms, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, we saw a very buttoned-up armory and really going by the book. Anytime there's an attack by a pirate on a ship, they have to stop. They have to contact the Coast Guard. They have to contact the government. They have to fill out a lot of paperwork. They lose money. And we heard plenty of stories of the pirate simply being shot and a conflict happening and the ship continuing on. Sometimes the pirate's being killed. No one ever talks about it. No one ever knows. But ultimately, I went into this with an idea that, okay, this is a private military companies with everything that's been happening with Eric Prince and Blackwater. It's a controversial industry. They have protected the shipping industry. The private military contractors, security guys, the mercenaries for hire have done a very good job of fighting piracy.
And here you are talking to essentially one of these first responders to deal with the piracy on the high seas.
They're just waiting for that one ship that hasn't got security on board.
So they've just gotten smarter about it because they know that there are gentlemen like yourself on board with guns.
Yep.
How fragile is this growth and progress that's been made?
There are people, not just pirates now. There's other people thinking about ISIS have threatened similar Somali-based pirate activities in the Mediterranean.
Now, who's that fellow protecting, or who does he say he's protecting in your conversation with him?
His clients?
Yeah.
Anybody who will hire him? They really tried to distinguish themselves. They said, we aren't mercenaries. We are offering security. We are private security guys. And, you know, the biggest threat to the maritime economy is piracy and terrorism.
There's always been an interesting tension between the protection of commercial shipping and military shipping that protects itself, protects territorial waters, gets involved in naval warfare, if we're talking about World War II and Korea, that sort of thing. Here you've got Admiral James Stavridis, who's a former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, talking about the apparent tolerance of his traditional naval outlook to these private contractors.
I think that PMCs are going to be part of the solution pretty much globally because the job is bigger than the military force that nations are going to be able to apply to it.
Why doesn't he think it's the responsibility of the combined navies of the world to patrol these waters, that it should be up to PMCs, the private military contractors.
Well, I don't think he's saying that they're the solution, but they could be part of the solution. You know, many of these governments, the Djiboutian government and the Sri Lankan government, are working with these armories. I mean, these guys have been in the theater of war, and then all of a sudden they're just floating at sea for days on end.
Did you get into a ship-to-ship confrontation?
No, we did not. We had no pirates rolled up on us.
Did you hope to?
I didn't hope to, but I did feel safe that if something was to happen, I was going to be protected because I was surrounded by an army and thousands of guns.
But still, it leaves room for a part two.
It does. It does. It was actually very, very difficult to gain access to these armories. We had multiple attempts. Again, it's a hidden world that hasn't really been filmed or shown before. So, you know, I don't know when that part two is going to happen.
Soroush Alvi is founder of Vice. His documentary Floating Armories airs tonight on HBO. We'll have more on the arms industry later this hour with a South African politician who reveals the collusion of weapons manufacturers, arms dealers, the military, and senior politicians. Have a big bill to pay caught without your wallet? Most places accept plastic. Everywhere accepts dollars as payment. But if you are caught without plastic or cash, if you have a stash of weapons in your trunk, it's not an exaggeration to say that with the proliferation of the arms trade in the 20th century, just about everywhere takes guns as money.
Lockheed Martin, Boeing, DynCorp International, Computer Sciences Corporation, and AeroVironment all told Eric about 70 companies are interested in this $1 billion contract.
As we look out 3, 5, 7, 10 years, this market remains a very much a growth market.
The Obama administration wants to sell bunker buster bombs, which can penetrate 20 feet of solid concrete, to the UAE.
Another U.S. arms deal with Saudi Arabia is in the pipeline, the biggest in history.
The Tribeca Film Festival is premiering a film next week called Shadow World, filled with some of those familiar names and some very unfamiliar voices. It's fair to say that the scale and influence of the global arms trade has never in one place been conveyed so powerfully. Andrew Feinstein started by writing a book on the arms trade when he was a politician in South Africa, a member of the ANC party under Nelson Mandela. But the effect of a $10 billion arms deal made by his party, the effect on the future of his country, changed him forever.
It was an example of my own leadership being prepared to undermine the institutions of our hard-won democracy that many of them had fought so bravely for in order to protect themselves and to protect the corruption that was going on. So I became interested in whether South Africa was unique or whether this was something that was happening globally. And unfortunately, what I discovered is that this is all too common globally.
And I think one of the things that every American should know is that what is not a secret is that the U.S. is the biggest arms supplier in the world. And that, as you portray in this film, the modalities and the style and the many of the institutions of the production of the arms trade are products of post-war America. Let's listen. Ricardo Privatero, who's an arms dealer in Europe.
The politics is dictated by the whims of the arms industry. Politicians are nothing more than sales reps, my dear friend. They have as much power as a middle-ranking executive in Lockheed Martin. At the end of the day, they do what they're told.
Lockheed Martin, a very important American defense contractor that's not only deeply involved in American politics, but involved in conflicts all over the world. The 20th century is a story of the growth of the arms trade in your country, but particularly directed by the United States. How do you tell that story in this film?
What we do is we show how the manufacture of weapons in the United States and the export of those weapons, as you say, virtually everywhere in the world, is completely intertwined with economic and political interests. So there is huge money to be made in this industry, both legal and illicit money. And what we do in the film is we take it from Smedley Butler through the Thatcher-Reagan revolution, because the deregulation of our financial systems was extremely important in effectively allowing these companies to operate as they want to, with virtually no meaningful regulation.
And the traditional sort of left-wing view of what your argument is would be, gosh, we're spending way too much on defense. We should be spending more on social programs. But in fact, this is a different argument. You're saying that the economy has become, in fact, the arms trade.
The national security elite today is mostly composed of people who hit the revolving door multiple times during their life.
The nomination of Richard B. Cheney to be Secretary of Defense is confirmed.
They make a name for themselves in the private industry, and then they come into the government. In essence, we in the United States have privatized the ultimate public function, war.
Now, who is that? Lawrence Wilkerson, U.S. Army colonel, retired. Is he a wacko, fringy, lefty?
This guy comes from a hardcore Republican background where he still locates himself, and he argues very strongly that there is an elite of business people and politicians who effectively drive this trade in weapons, drive this trade in the making of war, which has become, as he says, a privatized industry, for their own benefit, for their own ends. And if one looks at the detail of this trade as we reveal in the film, it's not just a matter of all of this money going into war. An enormous amount of this money is misspent. On the arms deals that I've investigated, bearing in mind that this trade accounts for 40% of all corruption in all world trade, anywhere between 10 and 35% of the money being paid out by governments goes into the payment of bribes.
We're talking with Andrew Feinstein, whose film Shadow World, based on his book, premieres at the Tribeca Film Festival next week. You've looked at this globally. Why would it be the case that arms serve this function? Wouldn't it be just as likely that medicine would serve this function? It's essential that food would serve this function. I mean, it sort of does, I suppose, ultimately.
Pharmaceuticals, food, various other commodities generally play a positive role in our societies. Weapons do not. Weapons are a necessity because of the nature of the world we live in. They are not, I believe, something that if we lived in a peaceful world, which unfortunately we don't, we would need. We could actually do without them. That's the first thing. The second crucial thing, by comparison to the other industries you mentioned, is that the manufacture and the trade in weapons is largely unregulated. So we have a situation in the world where the trade in bananas is more heavily regulated than the trade in weapons. Now, the reality is that weapons are a hell of a lot more dangerous than bananas. So I think that's what sets this industry apart, first of all, the fact that it's underregulated, and it's willfully underregulated. It is, again, what Wilkerson describes as the national security elite. It is this amalgamation of politicians, of business people, and of military people who ensure that the industry is located where and how it is. So this is not something that is happening per chance. This is something that is organized, not in some form of conspiracy or something, but this is something that is organized during the regular conduct of politics, of military activity, of foreign policy, and crucially of business. And what it does is it reflects to me as a former politician, a former banker, the nexus, the intersection between business and politics that is extremely damaging to both. And that's part of the reason why we've made this film. It's part of the reason why myself and my team have such a fascination with this industry, because it has an enormous impact on the way we live, on the way we die, on the way we're governed, on the way our tax dollars are spent. So it's crucial to so much of our existence, but most people don't pay attention to it. It's very, very difficult to get at the information that lies underneath this very secretive trade. And what you find out isn't particularly comfortable.
Andrew Feinstein is a former South African politician and the author of Shadow World, Inside the Global Arms Trade. The film, based on his book, premieres at the Tribeca Film Festival. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
You want answers?
You haven't answered my question.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
So, do you come to Milwaukee often?
You know how fast you're going?
How can we be expected to teach children to learn how to read if they can't even fit inside the building?
You're gonna have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
You can't handle the truth!
We can handle Rafer Guzman, who's the film critic for Newsday, on a Friday when the cold weather just will not let go in the East. So movies are definitely an option this weekend. Hello, Rafer.
Hi, John.
We've got three interesting offerings this weekend. Hardcore Henry. This looks a little bit like the Bourne franchise. Tell me about it.
So this is a movie that is shot almost entirely on GoPro cameras mounted to a stuntman's head. You are Henry. You're a super cyborg soldier who has woken up in a clinic. You've got no memory of what's happened to you. There's a nurse there that you are apparently in love with, and when she's kidnapped, you have to go rescue her, and the entire film is shot in first-person point of view.
Here's a clip.
Hello, Henry. Relax, okay? Scan?
Sensory processor activated.
This next part might hurt. Squeeze? Do you remember how you got here?
Does it hold up?
Well, I think it does, as long as you don't bother with the plot or any kind of logical details whatsoever. There's a guy in this film who has supernatural powers. That's not even glancingly explained in this movie. But I will say it's a lot of fun. It's just a great piece of pulp cinema. And the gimmick actually, I think, really holds up, at least for the space of this pretty short action film. I really enjoyed it. Not everyone has, but I thought it was a real kick. I loved it.
Is it a gimmick, or will there be more films made like this, or certain films made like this? Does it have a narrative quality?
I think that's, I think you're aiming a little too high there, John. This is mostly about action and punching people in the face and getting punched, and that's the fun of the film.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
You're not sold.
Exactly. The Boss has Melissa McCarthy, Peter Dinklage, Kristen Bell. This is the big blockbuster of the weekend. Any thoughts? And we'll hear a clip.
Melissa McCarthy plays Michelle Darnell. She's sort of an empire builder, a Martha Stewart figure without the class, I would say. And she gets thrown in prison for insider training. And when she gets out, she has to stay on the couch of her former assistant. That's Kristen Bell.
If your breasts could speak right now, I think they'd be saying, Claire, please don't zip me up in your jeans. You're going to zip a nipple.
That's not what they'd say. May I adjust your strap? Because I'm trying to help you, Claire. You say be more helpful, and I'm trying to be helpful.
You can tighten the strap.
Okay.
What? Just a little.
Because I want.
What is that toggle? Oh, it's a nursing bra.
Oh, my God. Are you still nursing Rachel?
I love Melissa McCarthy. Does this work?
I love her, too. This is not one of her best films, I would say. It's not nearly as good as Spy. It's not nearly as good as The Heat. But Melissa McCarthy is such a great improviser. I mean, you can just hear her riffing right there. And you can tell she, you know, it's probably did 3 hours of that before they chose the best stuff. She's great at that. It's hit and miss, but I think there's enough fun stuff in this comedy to make it worth seeing.
Number three, Demolition. Here's a clip.
Your whole house is just lovely.
Aside from the appliances, it's the kind of house people dream of living in.
I hate this house. It's just shiny stuff.
Great cast, spooky plot.
Yes, he's grieving for a dead wife, or at least he's trying to grieve. He can't seem to summon up his feelings, so he starts demolishing everything in his life. That's Jake Gyllenhaal. He plays a Wall Street banker. I think this film wants to be a very profound drama. It's directed by Jean-Marc Vallée, who did Dallas Buyers Club. It doesn't work. It's too mawkish, too contrived, and I didn't buy a single thing in it.
Ooh, Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Have a great weekend, Rafer.
Thanks. You too, John.
Happy Friday also brings us a visit from our joyful scavenger from the world of, hey, check this out, or stop and smell the roses. You know that person in your life who's always turning you on to new, cool stuff, changing your channel, shaking up your playlists, whose sentences begin with, you are going to love this. For us, that joyful scavenger is culture reporter Melissa Locker, whose work is featured in The Guardian, Time, Vanity Fair. Melissa, go ahead. Make my day.
I think you are going to fall in love and waste a lot of your free time on a new website called Radio. And that's Radio with 5 O's at the end of it. So radio.com.
And what can I do on this?
This website will take you around the world, let you click on a map, and let you play whatever they're listening to.
So I can just, on the map, click on a city.
And it pops up a little window and it starts streaming music. So, for example, you could listen to the same thing that everyone in Lithuania is listening to. kind of nice, some electronic, a little funky, a little, you know, post-industrial. It's good.
Now, is that all I can do, is hear the top 40 in each one of these cities?
Not at all. This website not only takes you around the world, it also takes you back in time. So you can theoretically click on any country and find out what they were listening to in a different era.
Oh, that's fantastic. So I could just, like, go to Argentina in the 30s?
Not a problem. Aren't you transported? Let's try another.
Okay, let's see. Philippines in the 70s.
Perfect. I think there was a lot of polyester. That sounds Brazilian.
Well, Philippines, I think heavy
island influence.
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. I think so. That makes sense. Although, you know, the great thing here is it wouldn't have to be correct. I would still buy it, right?
Oh, sure. And also, it's not like the radio has to be locally made. It could be what they were listening to from around the world. So maybe there was a lot of influence of Brazilian music in the Philippines in the 1970s.
And you could use this just as, like, your basic music app. You put up the map and you just go, Siri, you know, Belarus, circa 1951.
Exactly. And it can also just stream in the background. Like, I had Colombian music in the 1950s playing all day, and it was fantastic. Think how much fun this could be at a dinner party, too.
Oh, my God, yes.
Right? You serve up a little Colombian food, and you have the music to go with it. Or you serve up, you know, Brazilian, or you serve up French cuisine from the 1960s and have yourself quite a French soiree. Jeune loup, parfois leurs yeux s'allument
quand passe une ingénue aux longs cheveux de lune. This is really terrific. You know, the next thing is TV shows.
But isn't that YouTube, basically?
It is, I guess. But you can't do a map on YouTube.
You can't do a map. But I bet if you typed in Lithuania 1950 TV, you could probably find something.
That's why you're so much smarter than me, Melissa. God.
I just spend too much time on the internet.
That's true. That's why you're happy.
Mm. That is the secret to happiness, spending too much time online.
Radio. RadioOOOO.com. Fantastic. Melissa Locker, who's very, very happy and also has the most neglected child in the world.
Absolutely.
Okay, there we go. Thank you very much. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org.